You can subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for only £12 for our print and online editions, plus get 6 months of digital access free to The Telegraph. Go to spectator.co.uk/telegraph.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. So today the papers are full of the latest sage predictions for, or sorry, I should say scenarios, because they're not quite predictions for what will happen with the second wave. James, what have we found out?
So Daily Telegraph today splashes on the suggestion that the second wave could be bigger than the first, that it's a different kind of wave than the first wave, in that the idea is it would go up and then it would stay at a very high number of deaths for quite some time before going down. And so it's not a steep mountain. It kind of goes up, plateaus, stays up and then goes down. And the question now is, what will the government do? We're already seeing more and more places move into tier three. There's a suggestion in The Sun today that basically the whole country is going to be in tier three by Christmas. This is, you know, I think a reference to kind of long-running joke that there was going to be a black gallows humour, you could say, but that you were going to avoid, that the government was going to avoid a national lockdown by the entire country apart from Cornwall being in tier three. And I think it is another reminder that as you look at the European numbers, that things are moving in the wrong way, and the US numbers actually right across the West. Now, tonight we get an address from Emmanuel Macron to the French people. These addresses have normally been used by Macron to explain the strategy and to an new restrictions, and there is a lot of buzz in Paris this morning that where Macron is going towards is something very close to a second national lockdown, something that he, like Boris Johnson, said that he was determined to avoid. And I think the significance of this is that when Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron spoke on the phone a few weekends back, you know, they basically were saying that, you know, we've got to stick to this path of kind of attempting regional restrictions to avoid a full national lockdown. If Emmanuel Macron has come to the conclusion that that doesn't work, it'll raise the question of whether Boris Johnson will do the same. And there is no doubt that leaders in these circumstances, they feel more comfortable. You know, they're all basically getting the same scientific advice. I mean, obviously from different scientists with some nuanced variation, but the fundamental advice they're all being given is the same. And I think it will raise the question of what is going to happen here if you see France going down that route tonight.
Isabel, a couple of weeks ago when Keir Starmer called for a national circuit breaker, that actually made Boris Johnson less willing to go for a national approach. But do you think it's pretty much unavoidable now?
It's still very difficult because, as the papers are also reporting, Boris Johnson's got an increasing number of his own MPs who are demanding an exit strategy from the existing local lockdowns that they have in their areas. So there's the letter from the Northern Research Group led by Jake Berry that was sent yesterday. And you can just see that the Conservative Party is sort of pulling in a completely different direction to where the data says things are going, and the prospect of a national lockdown was actually something that brought the party back together briefly. A recent Prime Minister's questions when Keir Starmer raised the idea of this circuit breaker, because it reminded Conservative MPs that things could be so much worse than what Boris Johnson had already imposed on them. So he's got a very difficult situation where the data is saying one thing, his Conservative MPs are focused on something really very different indeed, almost acting as though things are getting better when, as the papers report today, things are indeed in fact getting worse, and it looks like a very bleak picture for the next few months. And Boris Johnson will have to really decide to face down his party if he's going to go for a national lockdown. But he also will have to decide to face down his party anyway, because local restrictions are not going to be disappearing in the next few months. And as James said, we will end up in a situation where most of the country is sort of de facto in a lockdown, apart from Cornwall.
And James, what is Number 10's thinking on this? Are they going to give more money for the places that are going to be in lockdown in anticipation of more places being in lockdown? Or are they going to say this is just modelling, you know, it might not necessarily happen? What's the thinking going on?
So I think if you look at the economic package that was announced, you know, the other week, the job support scheme, which made much more generous, the grants to businesses, I mean, those are essentially designed to deal with lots more places ending up in tier two and then tier three eventually. I think, as Isabel said, there is an interesting question here, which is the Tory party of kind of reluctantly accepting local restrictions with this support, but they kind of want them to go quite soon. as you say, the push from the scientists is all these are here for quite some time. I think in a way, one of the other things that matters is where everybody else is. Like, one of the reasons why Boris Johnson had so much trouble with his own party with the rule of six was that the rule of six was actually being more strictly enforced in the UK than anywhere else. In Scotland, they excluded primary school aged children from it. In Wales, it didn't apply if you met up outside. And I mean, that's one of the things that drove Tory MPs so wild, was it looked like the government here in London was taking the strictest approach. I think it is now quite clear, you know, Wales having gone for a circuit break, Nicola Sturgeon having announced her five-tiered system, and you look at what's happening internationally with Ireland moving into a kind of soft lockdown, what's going to like to happen in France and Germany this week, you know, all of the situation is changing. I think the big question here, which is, what is the relief? You know, the government talk a lot about the cavalry in terms of, you know, either a vaccine or testing. And you saw the government, the testing capacity shoot up yesterday. It now looks like the government will hit this 500,000 capacity to do 500,000 tests a day by the end of this month. If those things do not arrive, what do you do? I think that is the interesting question. I think what's happening in Belgium right now is fascinating, because there have been a kind of view that if you got hit badly by the first wave, you are unlikely to get hit badly by the second wave.
Mm.
Belgium's hit very badly by the first wave, now looks like to be hit very badly again by the second wave. So I think all of these things are complicating the question, but also begging the fundamental issue, which is, if this vaccine does not arrive in the spring, as people have suggested, what is the strategy?
And Isabel, you're based in Barrow-in-Furness, and your MP, Simon Fell, was actually one of the signatories to this NRG Northern Research Group letter this week. What was the mood like there? Is it under... Can you first of all remind listeners what tier it's under and what's the mood like there?
So Barrow is, like London, in tier two. And I think there's a sort of weariness in Barrow and in lots of parts of the northwest at how long restrictions have been going on. I have to say that it's probably worse in some areas. So a lot of my family live in Warrington, and they've had restrictions for a lot longer and are much wearier, and say they've just had a rotten few months, basically, particularly with Liverpool and Manchester so close, with those cities both in lockdown as well. I think it's also worth pointing out that there is a lot of anger as well about the free school meals row, and MPs in these former red wall seats have been getting a huge amount of opprobrium from constituents. And this is really their first taste of political anger. And so it's not just the lockdown restrictions. They're also having to really fight a fire on another front, which is on free school meals. And there is I don't know what Simon Fell's private view is on this, but a lot of Tory MPs in these areas are anxious that they don't be seen, that they don't end up being seen to defend the current free school meals stance, because they're worried that there will be some kind of U-turn, even if it is the clubs that are being discussed by the government to feed children during the Christmas holidays, because they are getting a huge amount of, well, abuse in some cases. Their constituency offices are really being flooded with a lot of local anger, and so that is shaking them up as well.
And James, meanwhile, you mentioned Scotland and the five-tier system, but the other big news in Scotland this week is the factional rivalry that's going on in the SNP in the aftermath of Alex Salmond being acquitted for his sexual assault charges. Can you update listeners on what's been going on there?
So Alex Salmond, the former First Minister, has written to James Hamilton, who's investigating whether Nicola Sturgeon broke the ministerial code in her handling of the whole Salmond issue, and essentially suggested some areas into which James Hamilton might wish to extend his inquiry. Now, these suggestions are, to put it mildly, not entirely helpful to Nicola Sturgeon.
What sort of things?
He basically is suggesting that the remit of this inquiry that he was given by the Deputy First Minister, John Swinney, is too narrow, and he might want to expand it to look here and look there. And I think the clear implication from the letter is that Alex Salmond thinks that if James Hamilton were to look in those places, he might find things. And I think that this is a big escalation in the long bubbling away Salmond-Sturgeon tensions, because if Nicola Sturgeon were found by this report to have broken the ministerial code. We all know what ministers who broke the ministerial code are meant to do in under the system. And so this is a big escalation in that Sturgeon-Salmon face-off. It's one of those stories that if it wasn't for COVID, I think would be getting far more attention than it is, because it is worth saying this. You know, if you look at the kind of focus groups in independence in Scotland, it is very, very hard to overstate Nicola Sturgeon's importance to the appeal of the SNP and the appeal of independence as a proposition. I think one of the reasons why support for independence has grown during COVID is that Nicola Sturgeon has, you know, essentially reframed the debate as, do you want me or Boris Johnson? And that Nicola versus Boris frame has worked very effectively for the Yes movement.
Isabel, as James mentioned, support for independence is still going up despite this factional rivalry. But do you think this is the sort of thing, if it continues to fester, is the sort of stuff that could perhaps save the unionists?
I think it would be dangerous for unionists to rely on this. I mean, they probably will. I was amused over the weekend by the briefings to some of the papers that the government's thinking of recruiting two more press officers and perhaps some more special advisers to save the union, as though that was really going to make the SNP quake in their boots. But there is a danger to the SNP here that it becomes distracted, and it is one of those parties that is generally able to be very, very single-minded, even during a pandemic, about independence. But having this fight from within, and an Alex Salmond who is determined really to turn on the people who he thought were trying to destroy him, that will cause internal rifts and more bickering between factions within a party that has been hugely united. But I think unionists relying on this to do anything for their cause would be perhaps dangerous, but also perhaps a little bit predictable.
Isabel and James, thanks very much. And here's one more plug for the podcast survey. You've been filling it out so nicely, but those of you who haven't yet, please do fill it out. It's at spectator.co.uk/podcast survey, and you can win a bottle of Paul Roger champagne. James, isn't that a good offer?
Paul Roger champagne is, I think, particularly necessary in the current times.
It's your favourite, isn't it?
It is my favourite, yeah.
Very loyal. So to get a chance to win James's favourite champagne, please go to spectator.co.uk/podcast survey. Only takes a few minutes, so thanks very much.